What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning into this episode of Eyewitness History. This episode, I speak with Landon Jones. Lanny is an author and magazine editor. His most recent book is Celebrity Nation, How America Evolved into a Culture of Fans and Followers. From 1989 to 1997, Jones was the head editor of People Magazine at Time Incorporated, the most successful magazine in publishing history. We discuss what it was like running the magazine, we discuss his book, and we discuss a lot more. And now I give you Lanny Jones. Okay, I'm here with Landon Jones. Lanny, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you. There's a lot that I want to go through, Lanny. I want to discuss People Magazine, life as a writer, life as an editor. Certainly, I want to go through your book titled Celebrity Nation, How America Evolved into a Culture of Fans and Followers. Before we scale that ground together, Lanny, please tell our listeners briefly who you are and what you do.
Well, my name is Lanny Jones to most people, although I write under the name of Landon Jones. I've been a lifelong writer and editor, journalist, and so I've really done it all my life since I was in college. And I went right to Time Incorporated and worked initially for Time Magazine and for Life Magazine as sort of an incompetent reporter. I turned out to be a better writer than a reporter. And then I became the editor of the Princeton University Alumni Magazine. And then I went to People Magazine when it started. And that just sort of took off like a rocket. And so that's been, and then I started writing books on the side. And so that's when what's happening.
Awesome. Thanks, Lanny. So when you were sort of getting your writing chops, your writing legs underneath you, were there any particular inspirations that you drew from?
Well, there were some writers I knew personally that were big inspirations. The nonfiction writer, John McPhee, I much admired him. Writers I've read, certainly Mark Twain, and because of the vernacular, his use of slang. I mean, Ernest Hemingway said all American writing began with Mark Twain, Huckleberry Finn. And then George Orwell, and as an essayist, and can't be topped. And he has a beautiful, simple, his style is as clear as a window pane.
Oh, man, that could be a whole other podcast because George Orwell happens to be one of my favorite writers. It's so interesting with him. He's tended to be known as a novelist, 1984, Animal Farm, and so forth. But you're dead right. I find his best prose comes out as his work as an essayist, To Shoot an Elephant, Politics and the English Language. My personal favorite has to be Confessions of a Book Reviewer, I think is my favorite essay of his that he wrote.
Oh, that's wonderful. I love the ones you mentioned. And if you get one book, the book to get is The Collected Essays of George Orwell. I mean, that is just a fabulous book.
Yep, I have it. Oh, man, it could be a whole other podcast. So then getting onto the editing side of things, Lanny, I'm just curious, in your mind, what separates a good editor from a bad editor?
Well, the good editor wants to tell their story in a straight line. And I used to tell my writers as a piece of advice to think of how you're going to end this story and then write to where you are now to that ending in a straight line. And if you did that, you didn't waste words. And so an editor who is trying to tell the story succinctly and directly and not have a lot of meandering around or wasting of words is what my idea of a good editor is.
Avoiding the purple prose, as they say, right?
Yeah, well, and to deal with the questions that may come up in the mind of a reader. So you have to empathize with the reader and say, what's the reader going to wonder? What are they going to know? One of my editors used to always write in my margin, or other people's margins too, un-understand. If he didn't understand it, he'd just write un-understand, and that's all he had to say. We had to go fix it.
Oh, that's interesting. I might abuse my power somewhat as an interviewer here, Lanny, and perhaps you can help me out with an issue that I've had as a writer. So I certainly understand the straight line style of writing. Execute concisely to, less is more, sort of mentality. I think one of my issues is sometimes I tend to puff my prose up with too much purple. You'll have to pardon the alliteration. So yeah, I have a tendency to make my prose a little bit too purple. If someone adheres to the straight line, concise style of writing, isn't there a slight risk of your writing becoming boring?
Oh, I don't think so. You can still look for an arresting metaphor and a good use of adjective. No, I don't think so. I just don't. I want to tell it succinctly, and I want to have the gripping metaphor. I mean, one time I made a list of the 10 best first sentences I'd ever read, and it's a charming first sentences, and I like the list. Like, you know, even a story like Goodnight Moon, I forget the first sentence is something to the effect of "In the morning, the goodnight moon." Oh, and George Orwell.
Yep.
1984. First sentence is something like it was midnight and the clocks were striking 13.
It was a bright, cold day in April and all the clocks were striking 13.
That's right. Thank you. You know it better than I do.
Ah. Wonderful. That's helpful to me, Lanny. I appreciate it. So then I better get on with it. How then did you become involved with People Magazine?
Well, I knew the people who started it because some of them I had met at Time Magazine when I worked there. And at one point, I was a writer of what was called the People section of Time, which was just a one-page section. And it was about people sort of in the news. And so when they started People, they called me up and said, you want to work on a day basis and come up and work? And I could do it in the summer because I was on an academic schedule. And so I did come up and I liked it. And so I was up for the third issue. And then I just basically stayed from then on. And I enjoyed it. And it became quite exciting because, for one thing, we didn't know what we were doing, and nobody was smart enough to know that we didn't know what we were doing. And it was newsstand only sale. And so the cover was very important to determining how we did.
Mm.
The first 13 issues all failed to make the rate base guarantee because we didn't know what to put on the cover. We thought it would be about politics. This was during Watergate. And so we put Martha Mitchell on the cover and Judge Sirica, the judge of the Watergate case. We put them on the cover. And it really wasn't until we discovered, guess what? Show business, television. And the first cover that made rate base was a guy named Telly Savalas on Kojak was his show.
Yeah.
And, but then we started going more and more in that direction and became more and more entertainment, so-called jiggle shows. And so it just sort of went more and more that way. That's what happened.
That's very interesting. I'd love to dig on that a little bit. I know the early days of People are very interesting. I'd love to talk about some of the early challenges. You sort of gleaned at it with the pivot into entertainment. If my research was correct, the staff would ride the freight elevator to avoid hearing, let's call it, the disparaging remarks from the Time guys. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that was, that literally true. We were the same company in the same building and the same elevators as people who worked at Time Magazine and Fortune. And these were popular journalism, were fairly highbrow. I mean, Time thought that they were going to decide what was important in the nation and then tell people what was important. And then here was People over here writing stories about, you know, Farrah Fawcett and models and, you know, so on. And so they were somewhat contemptuous. It was awful in the elevator because we'd hear them talking. They didn't know we worked there. And we would hear them complaining about people. And so we couldn't stand riding the regular elevator. So we started taking the freight elevator just so we weren't riding with all the riders from Time.
Oh, that's extraordinary. So then I'd love to map out then your beginning there and then your rise as the managing editor of People. Would you mind running through that for me?
Well, in my case, we sort of hung in there. It was all-nighters week after week. And I hung in there. I spent a little time as the managing editor of of Money Magazine. And so I became used to running a magazine. And I'd done that at the Princeton Alumni Magazine. So I like running magazines. And so I guess I was basically recognized for that. So they appointed me the editor of People. And I did the best I could.
So then as managing editor, Lanny, what were your day-to-day responsibilities there, if you had to characterize them?
It was too much because you chose a story list, all the stories that would be in the issue, and you would participate in the laying out of the stories, which photos would lead a story. And most importantly, you would choose a cover. And the cover was a multi-million-dollar decision every single week.
Hmm.
And so you didn't want to get it wrong. And I did a couple of times. I put a male model on the cover named Fabio, and it was a complete bomb. And so I learned a lesson from that, sort of. And then we would do focus groups and try to figure out what people wanted on the cover. what they were interested in. And I used to go to focus groups. The focus group moderator would warm up the crowd by saying, "So who are your heroes?" And they would all say whoever the heroes were, you know, whatever it would be, you know, George Washington or John F. Kennedy. They would, or so some sports figures, Dan Muzio, they had heroes. But then one time, what I noticed was she did not ask that question. So after the focus group, I said, "Well, what happened to the heroes question?" She said, "I stopped asking it." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "Well, because they can't think of any." And that was something revealing about their sort of, they had no trouble thinking of celebrities, but they couldn't think of heroes. And so somehow the moral authority was getting lost in terms of who we were publicizing. And that's when I thought, you know, there's a book in there somewhere about the battle between celebrities and heroes. And that's when I first started taking notes. You know, I took notes for 10 years for the book that is now out there, Celebrity Nation.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. Thank you, Lanny. Moving on, I'd love to know, what is Stolle's Law? Named for Richard Stolle, I assume?
Yeah, this is Dick Stolle, who was the first editor of People. And he learned the hard way. But his style, his law, which he finally figured out, was in terms of cover choices. Who would you put on the cover? He would say, well, young sells better than old. And then pretty sells better than ugly. Rich is better than poor. So you put rich people on, not poor people. TV sells better than movies because the audience is larger. And movies sells even better than music, which is a more segmented and refined audience. And movies, TV, and music were all better than sports, which is very particular to fans. And anything was better than politics. And so we learned not to put politicians on the cover, which we did, you know, disastrously a couple of times. There were a couple of modifications of that that I did as the editor. One is dead is better than alive. People were very interested in a celebrity death. I don't know how else to put it. When Princess Grace died in a car accident, it became the biggest seller we had. We didn't even know when Stolle said his biggest mistake as the editor, when Elvis Presley died, he did not put it on the cover. He put out Anne Margaret or someone on the cover. And so it was a lesson that was painful to learn sometimes, but we did.
Yeah. Thank you, Lanny. Well, Lanny, I'd like
I can add one other point.
By all means, feel free.
A much later point, for me anyway, personally, was that the white was better than black. And so it took a long time for black Americans to wind up on the cover of People. In the first 2 years, there were maybe two black Americans on the cover of the first 69 issues. Wow. And so it didn't really happen. And that was because the mass market wasn't apparently not ready for it. But we got there. Thank goodness.
We got there. Better late than never, as they say, right?
Yeah, well,
love to talk to you about People's role in merchandising and illusion. So, you know, to quote you, we told the public we were writing about extraordinary people, but in reality, we were portraying celebrities as ordinary people, end quote. Do you think you could elaborate on that for me, Lanny?
Yeah, surely. Well, when we wrote stories about stars, we actually did not try to make them hagiographies. We wrote them as ordinary, about them as ordinary people. So the rules were, We had to have what we called a home take. That means the photographer would take photos at the star's house, not at the agent's house, not in front of the Bel Air Hotel. You know, it was always right in their house. And we would see the way they really loved, really lived, and what kind of wine they served, what kind of dog they had. And we always wanted the dogs and the pets in the pictures. And so we wanted to know the names of the dog. And that became an requirement for everybody we did. So we wanted their home take, and we wanted it to make them look like us, to make them look familiar, recognizable, and not as godlike.
Huh. Interesting. No iconography allowed. That's a good philosophy.
No.
This next question I've been itching to ask you. I want to talk to you about the 1996 Hollywood blackout. Please explain to our listeners sort of what this was and how you were involved.
Well, this was of the covers I was worked on and was responsible for, the one I took the greatest pride in. And it happened because I went to the Academy Awards one year before it. And I was sitting up at a balcony at the live Oscars watching the ceremony. And I noticed there were a bunch of people standing in the wings, sort of in the aisles on the side. And they were all dressed up, too. And I said, well, who are those people? And they said, oh, those are the seat fillers. And the seat fillers, it turned out, if somebody had to pick up an award or go to the bathroom, the seat fillers ran and sat in their seat. And they were, so there were never embarrassingly empty seats shown on television. So they were the seat fillers. But the seat fillers, guess what? They were all white. And so I realized that the whole audience was white. And even when Hollywood could have faked diversity by having it with the seat fillers who were not nominated for Oscars, they were just, I said, who are they? And they said, they were the cousins and friends of the members of the Academy. And so I thought, wow, there's a story there. So the next year, when the nominees were announced for the Oscars, we deliberately went and asked and found out how many of them were black. And it turns out there were two black nominees out of 160-something nominees. And it was really, really revealing. And so we did a cover called Hollywood Blackout that was normally the kind of cover you'd expect to see in, you know, the New Republic or somewhere like that.
Yeah.
But, and it of course, bombed. Nobody bought it. But to the credit of the publisher, they let me do it. And we did. And I'm very proud of it. And it was the first time someone had called Hollywood short. And said, hey, look, you know, you are not diverse. And the people you're putting in the movies and even the people who vote for the Oscars and even the people who sit in the chairs of the people who vote for the Oscars, you know, it was all white. So that was a Hollywood blackout issue.
Yeah. Wonderful. Would you consider that to be your proudest moment with people?
Yeah, I did, because it was something, you know, that went against the grain. No one wanted to hear it. People complained. But it generated a huge amount of coverage everywhere. And so, I mean, people went away. When once we said it, they said, oh, yeah, you know, I recognize that. And so I was very proud of bringing something new into the world, this new idea. But it still took 20 more years for the Oscars so white movement to take root.
Right, right. Absolutely. Well, and as you point out, it's a subject matter that would be more, one would think would be covered by, yeah, the New Republic or the Nation magazine, you know,
yeah,
what have you. Extraordinary. Thank you, Lanny. You've written that a primary principle of celebrity journalism is, to quote you, write about a woman with a problem, end quote. Would you mind just kind of telling me a bit more about that?
Well, yes. It's a phenomenon. Well, most of our buyers were female, and we began to figure that out. Mm. So if you had a story about, I think it was Karen Carpenter, who maybe died of an eating disorder. Mm-hmm. And she was a woman with a problem. And they sold many, many copies. And people were just wanted to read about that. The Princess Grace of Monaco, when she died, was a woman with a problem. I mean, the ultimate woman with a problem was Princess Diana, who I actually met at one point.
Oh.
And I hosted at an event. But she was a woman with a problem with her marriage and the royal family. And so and she was on the cover more often than any other person.
Right, right. Well, I feel kind of forced to ask, what was it like meeting Princess Diana?
Oh, it was fun. I went and had tea with her, firstly, at Kensington Palace, where she lived in London. And she was charming, nice, sort of giggly. You know, she laughs and puts her hands over her face. And she was fun to be with. She wasn't stupid, but she was smart, but she sugar-coated it, I would say. And she talked then about the media and how she was trying to warm up to Mr. Murdoch, as she called him, Rupert Murdoch. And then later on, as a result of that coffee, we hosted a fundraising dinner for her in Chicago, where she could raise money for her charities and we could raise money for our charities. And I sat with her at dinner, and that was fun. Got to know her. She telling me, oh, you know, Charles and, I mean, William and Harry are so tall now. And I said, I had the opportunity to dance with her. But they said, well, before you do, there's a questionnaire. And so the questionnaire was, well, you had to be married. And I said, well, yes, I was married. And so you had to be happily married. I said, well, yes, I was happily married. Then you had to be a good dancer. And I said, well, you're darn right. And then they said you had to be 6 feet tall. And that one I flunked. So I never did dance with her.
Damn.
Yeah.
That's a wonderful story, Lanny. So last question that I have on people, Lanny, if I may.
Yeah.
I'd love for you to talk about how people came up with new journalistic tools to do end runs around celebrities' efforts at controlling media access, right around tertiaries, etc. Yeah.
Well, the publicity agents who handle those stars, you know, were frightened of scandal and misquotes or whatever. And so they would not cooperate sometimes and not offer an interview, and there would be no home take. And in those cases, we just flew armies of reporters at the story who interviewed everybody. And we would call that a swarm. There would be a swarm of reporters, like a swarm of bees or whatever, you know, attacking. And then we call their stories would be a ride around, which meant that there was not an interview. And we would interview everybody else who knew the person. And we still see this happening in journalism. I'm not real proud of it. But it was the only way we could get some of the stories was with a swarm. And right around, you know, the reporters would hang out in a hotel lobby waiting to interview somebody who knew the celebrity, that kind of thing.
Right. Understood, Lanny. Great. So then pressing onward, Lanny, the book is called Celebrity Nation, How America Evolved into a Culture of Fans and Followers. Firstly, I'd love to know, what was it that made you decide to write the book?
Some of it was a story I mentioned about the conflict between heroes and celebrities. What was that all about? And then what made me write the book was noticing the compelling interest that celebrities generated that it did not seem to have been earned it somehow. And I wanted to figure that out. How did that happen? And so I began to realize that it was related to technology and that the first celebrities were related to the visual image. And so, and most recently, it would be like Charles Lindbergh or Albert Einstein, their photographs at newsreels and on newspapers. And then it became Hollywood and the image that Hollywood generated of one star I met, for example, Elizabeth Taylor, you know, and Marilyn Monroe. People like that, they were generated, and it was technology. And the more the technology changed, the more interest it was generating. And so then it became after the Hollywood stars and television and the reality shows, and each one was an innovation. And then in 2006, when the social media started and saw all of that broke loose, and then I started to add it all up. There's a book in there about the relationship between technology and celebrityhood and our ability or inability to control it. Like I'll tell you, Josh, the first famous person the world knew was Alexander the Great. Now, why was it Alexander the Great? Because he was the first human to be had his head put on a coin. And that was a new technology, and that was an image of Alexander. And so that's how it happened. Before then, there had been gods. And what happened there a little bit, and you still see this, was that the reverence and we give to gods is transferred to celebrities. And even in the church where a minister is called the celebrant, it's the roots of the word or celebrity or celebrate is the link between humanity and the divinity. And that's still there.
Wow, that's fascinating, Lanny. The book talks about the introduction of printed books and the rise of what you call literary celebrities. This ranges from Samuel Johnson to Rousseau. Samuel Johnson has a bit of a special place in my heart. For our listeners, he's the inventor, compiler, I should say, of the first dictionary. I'd love for you to elaborate on the rise of what you've called the literary celebrities.
Well, the literary celebrities were people who were in books. And oftentimes they had a frontispiece of photo, an image of them, a drawing of them in a book. And that was certainly true of Samuel Johnson. A very funny quote I have in the book is one from him, which is when he became well known, he said, "I was not compensated, you know, in equivalence to my fame." So he was complaining about it, about not getting paid enough. And this was true of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who became a celebrity in France. But he didn't know that. So when he'd go outside and take a walk at the Tuileries or want to play chess outdoors in an outdoor chess game, he was besieged by people. And he complained about that and didn't like it. And later on, other people manipulated, not so much literary celebrities, but people like P.T. Barnum,
yes,
you know, and Buffalo Bill, who became the first entertainment celebrities. And an actress, an English actress named Sarah Bernhardt, knew how to, in effect, manipulate the media and get attention, get a picture in the paper, and became a celebrity.
That's very interesting. You mentioned Lindbergh, you mentioned Elizabeth Taylor. Prompts me to want to ask the question, Lanny. How has the arrival of newsreels and radio fed the rise of the modern celebrity?
Well, newsreels and radio were very important in the case of Charles Lindbergh, when he became literally the most famous human on Earth because of newsreels, because of his flight across the Atlantic. And so that's why there were huge crowds waiting for him to land, because people were already seeing it or heard it on the radio. And the radio was made possible by the first transatlantic cables that arrived just before Lindbergh's flight. So these things all happened together, the newsreels, the radio, and then Lindbergh. Now, in the case of Einstein, it was similar, and he was a distinctive image. And we still see people playing Einstein characters on television. And so Einstein was ambivalent about his fame, but he would make fun of it. But then on the other hand, one of his good friends was Charlie Chaplin, and he went to Hollywood and toured a studio. So everyone chews on this bark.
I'd love to maybe talk about then the rise of television as an avenue for the celebrity. We have celebrity presidents, Ronald Reagan, Donald Trump, Schwarzenegger, if we're just going to expand it out just in terms of celebrity politicians, right? We could play this game all day, really. And then we have the arrival of reality television, smartphones, social media. And I'm just curious how these new forms of media have impacted the celebrity identity.
Well, it's what's happened is that it's created the existence of what the former Librarian of Congress, Daniel Boorstin, called people who are known for being well-known. Or well-known for being well-known. And so they were famous, but you didn't know why. And that is still going on. And so the Kardashians would be the classic quintessential example of people who became famous by reality television. But reality television, people forget, it began with a family called the Loud family. And they were on PBS, on public television. But it migrated from public television to commercial television, really to everywhere, the reality television movement did.
I'm
150 reality television shows. One story I'd like to tell you, was told to me by my friend Jim Gaines, who was the editor of Life magazine. And they were planning to do a Life magazine cover, and was going to be a cover of Mel Gibson, but then they started testing and doing focus groups. It was going to be the December issue. And so they decided to change the cover, and they decided to change it to the topic to God. But then they said, well, somebody has to call up Mel's people and tell him. And so somebody called up Gibson, I think Gaines may have, and said, you're no longer on the cover. And this is the publicist. And the publicist said, well, who's going to be on the cover instead of Mel? And Gaines said, it would be God. And the publisher said, well, Mel would be very disappointed. But I think that God and Mel are still on talking terms.
I dare say they are, yeah. I'd love to know a little bit about the research process for the book. What sort of research did you do for it?
Well, for a long time, when I met a big celebrity, and this would be like Ronald Reagan or Bill and Hillary Clinton, Princess Diana, people like that, I would, George Bush 41 and Barbara Bush, I would write a memo to myself. And so I just wrote up long memos about what they were like, what they did, and what I learned from them about celebrity. And it was revealing. And I had a box full of these memos. And that was the start of it. From then on, I started doing what my monitor, academic research, looking up scholarly articles that have been written about why little kids, want to be famous and that's it these days. So when they're 9 years old and you ask a child, what do you want to be when you grow up? They say, I want to be famous, or I want to work as an assistant to a star. And this is different than it used to be. So the amount of bandwidth that's been eaten up by celebrities like that. Also, the scholars have studied celebrity worship and celebrity worshipers and tried to understand their characteristics. And one of them is that, for example, the more a person is into celebrity worshiping, you worship celebrity, the less involved they are with public affairs, communities. There's a book out there called Bowling Alone. It's about how people are no longer joining bowling leagues. And that is something to do with the celebrities replacing that. And so the people are becoming obsessed with the internet, celebrities, cell phones, but are no longer supporting their community and their PTA board. And this has something to do, I think, with the divisions that we see in America these days. And so I'm hoping somehow that celebrities can help us bring us all back together and be one, you know, one nation rather than this divided group of people all worshiping different celebrities.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with that. I hope we can get back to it. Is there a particular thing that you're looking to have readers take away from the book, Lanny?
What do I like readers to take away?
Yeah.
I think to be sobered and concerned about celebrity, what I would call celebrity and its discontents, that it's worrisome and it's hard to escape from it. And particularly when they are leading us and we don't know where they're leading us to. So that said, I mean, to sort of step back from celebrity and look at leadership and values that are apart from the celebrity world. So, I mean, that's my deep hope is that people will be able to do that, just to put celebrity over in another box. And then the things that are important to them are in their own box.
Yeah. Sort of compartmentalize it.
Yes. Mm. Yes. The way it used to be.
Yeah, the way it used to be, much like a number of other things I could name, religion, politics, and so forth.
Yeah.
We got to all get to work organizing our organizing our cabinets.
No.
That was actually all the questions I had, Lanny.
I think those are most of the things. And thank you for asking a number of very good questions.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate you saying that. That's kind of you. So, Lanny, you might have to forgive the questions somewhat, but I'd love to know, is there anything embarrassing that's ever happened to you in your career?
Well, there's some choices. But the one that got the most publicity involved an actor named Abe Vigoda.
Mm-hmm.
You maybe remember him from a TV show, Barney Miller. And he was also in The Godfather Part 1 and maybe briefly in Part 2, where he played someone named Tessio. So in about 1982, I was editing a story about Abe Vigoda of people. And I read the story and I thought, well, he's dead. And so I wrote into the story, the late Abe Vigoda. And so the issue came out. Well, Abe Vigoda was alive and well, and he was not dead. He called a press conference to announce that he was in, and he posed in a coffin. This was in 1982. He lived for about 38 more years or something. He died in 1916. And so that was quite embarrassing. But as I was writing this story in my book, I realized that also that when somebody has been, a celebrity has been missing from the public arena for a while, you start to conclude that the person must be dead. And that was sort of a sobering afterthought to the embarrassing Abe Vigoda story.
That's funny. You make me think of it, Paul McCartney and so forth, right?
That's right. Yeah, this thing sees the imagination. I forgot about McCartney.
Yeah. Well, I remember the Beatles leaned into it too. There was that one album cover where they showed the three Beatles, but Paul McCartney, it was his back turned towards the.
Is that it?
Yeah. Yeah. So they definitely, they didn't exactly do anything to dissuade the rumor. Lanny, I want to make sure that we cover anything and everything that you have on. I gather you have a list in front of you of topics. Is there anything that you want to make sure that you get out?
I wrote down a few things, and we talked about all of them, really.
Excellent.
Things that were sort of either funny or important. there's no other one thing. I mean, that's, I think you hit the highlights.
Excellent. I like hitting
the highlights. Way to go, Joshua.
Boom. I'll take it. I'll take it. Coming from you, that means a lot. I appreciate that. Well, Lanny Jones, this was a real pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time for me.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. You take care, sir.
Okay. You take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Podcast Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and Richard Lim's This American President, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.